From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum next, local psychiatrist and neurobiologist Samuel Berendez joins us in studio for the hour to discuss his most recent book on personality. To what degree can we scientifically measure personality? And how much can understanding the nature and differences of personality help us in our lives, our work, and our relationships? We'll talk all about that next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Dr. Samuel Berendez joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, Robertson Professor and Director of the Center for Neurobiology and Psychiatry at the University of California School of Medicine here in San Francisco. Samuel Berendez is the author of Molecules and Mental Illness, Mood Genes, and Better Than Prozac, and his most recent book is Making Sense of People, Decoding the Mysteries of Personality. He served as director of UCSF's Langley Porter Psychiatric Institute and as president of the McKnight Endowment Fund for Neuroscience, as well as chair of the board of scientific counselors of the National Institute of Mental Health, and joins us for this second hour. Good to have you.
It's my great pleasure, Michael.
Delighted to have you back here. It's been a number of years. How many years since your last book?
It's about 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, well, that sounds about right. Me too.
So that's, yeah.
But this is really one that I know is going to be of a lot of interest to listeners, particularly because it gets into an attempt to really scientifically and systematically tell us what personality is. And immediately, of course, many people think, well, scientific, something to study. Yeah, but didn't Malcolm Gladwell tell us we have a blink, an immediate intuitive sense of personality?
Malcolm Gladwell was right. We do. In fact, we have an incredible ability to instantly take a measure of people, just as we have an incredible ability to see things. I mean, we instantly think about it. We just look at something, and our brain gives us this picture with all its complexity, and we do it all automatically. So we have a somewhat similar kind of process for sizing up people, because in our lives, we've got to immediately, when we meet somebody, make some assessment of, can I trust this person? Is this person going to harm me? Is this person somebody I want to get interested in? So we have a system for doing that, and it serves us very well.
We means a whole continuum, though, doesn't it? Because there's some people who are just really dense about those
things. Yes. Like everything in psychology, there is a continuum. That is, some people are better and some people are worse. But on the average, we do have this ability to blink, to use Gladwell's term, and to get some sense of what the person is like. And that serves us pretty well, and we're pretty good at it. In fact, studies show that people are pretty good at it. They're not bad. But they make a lot of mistakes. And there are times in our relationships with people where we want to step back and actually think through what's going on with this person. What do I understand about this person? And then all that information that we've blinked on and that we've stored in our heads needs to be assimilated and figured out in some way. And regrettably, because the blinks seem to work so well, none of us have really been taught a good system for taking all that information and figuring it out. And I propose in my book, based on the work of hundreds of people, a simple way to boil it down so we can think thoughtfully in certain circumstances about people in our lives.
Boiled down to 5 general characteristics, which I want to talk with you about.
Yes.
But before we do that, you talk about all the researchers, and you got the big names here, a lot of synthesis of so much research, Costa and McRae and Gordon Alport and Francis Galton, all these people. Is there a theory, though, behind a lot of these researchers that you can kind of move into a realm where you can really locate personality and understand it in a finite way, when personality seems to be often so fluid and protean? You know, it's changing. It's changing sometimes when you're with authorities as opposed to people who are under your authority and so forth and so on.
Yes. So the idea of personality is that there is a characteristic way of thinking, feeling, and acting, you know, within a certain range that is typical of a particular person. That is, if you get to know somebody, you have a sense of how they're going to think, feel, and act within a range. I mean, obviously, in certain circumstances, that range will be extended in one direction and in another. But people clearly are different. Everybody reacts in their own unique way to a variety of circumstances. Although people are also very much the same in many ways, there are distinct, separate ways of distinctively being, and that's what we call personality.
And that's something we can understand the way we understand baseball, wine, or music, you argue.
Well, yes, baseball, wine, and music are also very complicated, but if we just go to a baseball game and we haven't figured out the rules and we just blink on it, all we see is a bunch of guys running around and throwing the ball and stuff like that. We don't know what's going on. But if we are scholars of baseball, then watching the Giants, you know, can be informative, distressing frequently at times, but much more interesting than if we just kind of look and say the guy swung at the ball and it went out the park.
Talking with Samuel Berendez, author of Making Sense of People, Decoding the Mysteries of Personality. So let's talk about these five areas that you go into in quite a bit of depth, five general characteristics that can really help pinpoint personalities and lead toward, well, understanding maybe more troublesome areas and leading toward, well, judgment of moral character, really. Isn't that where the trajectory?
Right. So the way that I break things down is that I start with what psychologists have really settled into as the basic dispositional traits that are the building blocks, if you will, of personality, which they call the Big Five, but which are hardly the whole thing. They're just sort of like a starting point.
And a base.
And there's a great deal of evidence that these dispositional traits, which are ways of describing pieces of behavior, each have a significant genetic basis. That is, that a lot of the diversity amongst people in the expression of these various traits is based on genes, but some is based on circumstances, etc. And here they are. There are five. And they are extroversion versus introversion. That is the person assertive, outgoing on the one end, or shy, somewhat withdrawn, more interested in being alone on the other? And, you know, with people, lots of people in between. So the
terms that come to us from Jung, in fact, I believe.
Indeed. The term extroversion versus introversion was indeed coined by none other than Professor Jung. That's absolutely correct. And in fact, he just if we're going to digress into history, he was interested in that because it was at a time when he was puzzling about his personal difference from Freud. What made him so different from Freud? And he decided that Freud was more of an extrovert and that Jung was more of an introvert. And that concept, he then wrote a book on personality types around 1920 or so, which has been extraordinarily influential. So yes, those words actually come from Jung.
So we've got one, extroversion.
Extroversion versus introversion.
And the others?
Okay. The second one is called agreeableness. Is the person warm and agreeable? Or at the other end, is the person kind of cold and suspicious of the motives of others? Agreeable people think others are good. They can trust them. Disagreeable people at the other end think people are kind of like sneaky and that they better be on their guard all the time. So that's dimension number two. And you can see why these are things we want to assess when we blink on somebody. We want to know how dominant they are, extroversion. We want to know, you know, what do they think? I mean, are they kind of trusting people or are they suspicious people? These are things we want to know right away.
These are important things. Of course, since we mentioned Jung, I could also hear people saying, well, if they're Leos as opposed to Scorpios, then, you know, and they try to find ways of figuring out those personalities through other means.
Well, I think the astrological view of personality is one where these basic ideas that we intuitively understand were attributed to constellations. We think that there are other better explanations for why this variation occurs. But I am not here to the fault, dear Brutus, lies not in ourselves but in our stars. Issues are not ones that we need to discuss at the moment.
We can run down some of the rest of these as the hour moves along, but what do these do for people in terms of just their everyday life to have these kind of distinctions and to know a personality type and to be able to type it?
Well, yes. What do they do? The dimensions, these five dimensions, which are, as I say, the building blocks, are all very natural things that distinguish individuals and that we all have naturally learned to notice. We notice. I mean, what they do for us is that they give us this measure of what is this kind of person like and what can I expect from this person, which we first learn when we meet them by making this quick assessment, and which we then elaborate as we learn more and more about them and learn how to categorize them in terms of these five factors. And we do it naturally, but we don't do it very thoughtfully. We do it naturally and we do it on the fly and it's pretty good, but it's just natural for us to do it. And these are dimensions that distinguish people. They really are ways of separating or describing the individual variations in the people we meet.
I should tell you, though, as a young man, I mean, adolescent, I took the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Test, which a lot of people took back then. And I remember thinking to my – they were very troubled by the results, not necessarily that I had a bad personality, but there was, you know, it was the old idea that people are very contradictory. I mean, they'd say to me, for example, something extroverted, like you'd like to be the life of the party. And, yeah, I'd like to be – you'd like to be alone studying books and in a library and spending – yes, I mean, both were true for me. I'm extrovert and introvert or – I'm agreeable and disagreeable, and so it goes with many people, doesn't it?
Well, yes, but on the average, some people are much more extroverted, and on the average, certain people are much more introverted. For example, just to take two recent Democratic presidents, Bill Clinton is the poster child for extroversion. Bill Clinton wants to be in a crowd, wants to be with people, can't live without people being all around him. His Democratic successor, Barack Obama, is kind of a loner. He actually likes to be off by himself.
No drama Obama.
That's right. Well, no drama also refers to in one of the other variants, the neuroticism one, which we haven't gotten to yet. And those are different. I mean, you can't tell me that there's not a modal difference between Bill Clinton and Barack Obama in terms of the dimension extroversion. Yeah, now Barack Obama can hang out with guys and slap them on the back. Yeah, and Bill Clinton can also go off by himself and read the newspaper. But there is a huge difference in that dimension between those two people. So it's not some kind of like everybody is the same and they bounce around from place to place. People do have characteristic scores, if you will, average scores on these dimensions, which really tell you something about what they're like.
In fact, you use some lines of Joe Klein's in describing Clinton and really feel that Klein captures that sense of Clinton, you know, going into a room and wanting to be the center of attention and all the things that we associate
Absolutely.
With extroversion. And that's – I mean, you use a lot of famous people here actually, which is sort of interesting, including some that border on – or maybe don't even border on – are sociopathic by some standards, Bernie Madoff and O.J. Simpson.
Oh, by any standards. Bernie Madoff and O.J. Simpson by any standards.
But you make a kind of – and this is interesting to me too. You make a kind of interesting distinction between narcissism and sociopathology,
yes.
That sociopathic behavior is sort of a cousin of narcissism?
Yes, I think that they're on a spectrum, yes. I think that the people we – see, now all these words are words that we've kind of concocted to kind of encapsulate an idea. They're highly imperfect and they're spectral. That is to say, people – you're not either a sociopath or not a sociopath. You can be a little bit sociopathic or a lot, and ditto with narcissism and the – so but let's – you ask about the relationship between narcissism and sociopathy, two words that are commonly bandied around, and they're actually quite interesting and important. Those two kinds of people think that they are special, that they are entitled and have no empathy for others. That is, both what we call narcissists or people with narcissistic patterns and people with sociopathic patterns believe that they are that they're entitled, that they're special, and that they can take from other people, that they need to receive from other people, and that this is the nature of things. This is the way they are, and this is what they deserve. The distinction that I make between them, and it's a porous distinction, but it's a kind of way of thinking about it, is that the narcissists are much more interested in adulation. They're much more interested in feeling that they're numero uno. The sociopath, they're unempathic. They will exploit anybody, but at the end, what they want is to feel like puffed up. Whereas the sociopaths, who also have no empathy and who also want to exploit other people, are much more interested in picking their pocket and getting as much from them as possible. They're less interested in being admired. They're much more interested in stealing the goods. So Bernie Madoff is, and people can be both. I mean, people can have dementia. You know, that is, they obviously overlap because this common sense, I'm special, is what unites them. And by the way, you can say, well, everybody. No, everybody doesn't think I'm special. There are lots of people who are at the other spectrum who think that I'm not special, that I'm actually not so good, that I'm vulnerable, that I'm weak, that whatever. So it's not everybody is a sociopath or a narcissist or in that spectrum. But the distinction I make has to do with this issue of feeling admired, which is a core desire of the narcissist, and feeling that you can get away with something, which is a core desire of the sociopath. And those people are different than you, Michael. You're not either one of those, based on my limited knowledge of you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I got exoneration from Dr. Berendez here. This new book is all about personalities. It's called Making Sense of People, Decoding the Mysteries of Personalities. And how much personality, you mentioned genes before, but how much personality goes back to really, well, the circuitry of our brains,
yes,
and neuroscience.
Yes, well, of course. Okay, so there is that we that is the two big questions about personality is, why are we different? Why do we have different personalities? And how are we different? So most of my book is about how are we different, because that's what we want to learn, how to describe and how to deal with the differences. But why are we different is also a very important area, and one that scientists have been very, very interested in for a long time. And although we don't know the details, what's been worked out in the last 20 or 30 years is that, one, there are two great accidents that make us different. One accident is which set of gene variants we happen to inherit. Some people inherit gene variants that make them more outgoing, and some people inherit gene variants that make them more detached and shy. And there's clear evidence that there are gene variants that move you in one direction or the other. So there's a genetic component. And the accident of which genes you got from mama and papa and which variants you got from mama and papa is a big determinant of your personality. The second big thing is the accident of your birth and circumstances, the world you were born into. Were you born in 14th century China, or were you born in 21st century America? Because the culture is different. The circumstances are different. The environment is different. Your nutrition is different. You have an iPhone versus a bow and arrow or whatever. There's all this other stuff. And those things, the accidental circumstances of your life experiences and the accidental circumstances of the genes that you make come together, and in the first 25 years of your life, as they interact and as they develop your brain, which takes 25 years to get finished, build circuits which in turn encode the dispositions which we call personality.
So that's really just nature and nurture again, isn't it, that you're saying?
It's nature and nurture.
I mean,
it's
working together, yeah.
Working together.
Creating actually your brain.
Creating actually your brain. But in contrast with what Galton struggled with when he first proposed that way of thinking about things, and of course it goes back to the ancients, we actually know a hell of a lot about it when it happens, some of the genes that are involved, how the circuits mature. The details, although we're far from having worked them out, are much clearer. And the picture that I just presented is not pie in the sky anymore. It's very well validated by a great deal of data.
Talking again with Dr. Samuel Berendez, author of Making Sense of People. And when we make sense of people, we can make better choices, presumably. I mean, you know,
yes,
in terms of friendships, in terms of romance, in terms of who to work for or who to have work for us, all of those kinds of things. I mean, in every aspect of our lives.
Yes, or we can try. It's certainly one of the potential benefits of making sense of people consciously, recognizing that the data that we use in making sense of them is stuff that we've picked up intuitively and is based on what we think is important and what we pay attention to, etc. But nonetheless, the ability to take that information and put it together into some coherent picture can indeed, in my view, help you to make some good decisions. Yes.
So we'll talk about the five, the big five. You mentioned extroversion and you mentioned agreeableness.
Yes.
And the others are conscientiousness, you mentioned neuroticism, and openness.
Yes. I'll just explain.
I want you to explain, but as you explain, also tell us, is there a hierarchy? Is one more important than the other?
No. No. No, they're all dimensions of what people are like, and they all play some adaptive role. For example, just to go back to extroversion versus introversion, why are some people extroverted and some people introverted? Why did evolution in its wisdom give us gene variants which bias people in different directions? These are just so stories, but they make sense.
Are you sure evolution isn't just a theory? Rick Perry is going to be debating that tonight.
Well, Rick Perry, we can deal with
just
that.
Just having fun. Sorry.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, so you can, and this has been shown. You can select. That is, in forgetting about people now, but using experimental animals like mice, you can select mice by breeding them to be more extroverted or more introverted. And why are all these gene variants present in the genome of the mice, which allows you to do this selection? Because presumably there are times in the history of mousedom when being outgoing in a safe environment was pretty advantageous because the outgoing guy could have more mates and can get more food and stuff like that, whereas the shy guy stayed back in the little hovel and didn't do that stuff. So when times are good and the world is plentiful and predators are scarce, being outgoing is a great thing to do. On the other hand, in circumstances in evolution when times are bad and where there are predators all over the place, it's much more safe to just stay home and be kind of like shy and introverted. And so presumably these kinds of selective forces acting at different times in evolution have given rise to gene variants or have selected for gene variants which incline one in direction one or direction two. And the same is true for the other dimensions of personality. That's a quick, short view of it, which I amplify somewhat in the book.
But you also amplify into how you can do troubleshooting by recognizing these five traits, traits of personality.
Well, in fact, that's right. I mean, I think that some of them are, to make things clear, again, troubleshooting depends on the wishes of the person who's doing the troubleshooting. Some people want to be in situations of a certain kind because of their personalities versus others. Some people want to select being with extroverts or being with highly reliable people who are high in conscientiousness or whatever, and others don't. I mean, so the issue of troubleshooting and the issue of selection is not just because
contingent on your own personality.
There's your own person. So there is no gold standard. This is the good personality in the eyes of everybody. Some people will vote for Rick Perry and some people will vote for Barack Obama. Clearly distinguishable with distinguishable personalities and distinguishable platforms. And yet some people will adamantly say this is good and others will adamantly say that is good.
Again, we're talking with Dr. Sam Barundas and his book is Making Sense of People, Decoding the Mysteries of Personality. I'm going to decode some of the mysteries of our listenership here by offering our number to you and inviting you to join this conversation. In fact, we welcome your joining the conversation, which you can do now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Welcome to the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, as we discuss the mysteries of personality. And mysteries, I think, is the operative and most apt word here. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. We'll hear from you when we return. Talking again with UCSF psychiatrist Samuel Barundas, I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Dr. Samuel Barundas, who is the author of a new book called Making Sense of People, Decoding the Mysteries of Personality. He's a psychiatrist at the University of California, San Francisco, and also directs the Center for Neurobiology and Psychiatry there. And is also the author of a number of other books, including Better Than Prozac, Creating the Next Generation of Psychiatric Drugs. You're welcome to join this program if you have something you'd like to say or ask about personality. Toll-free number 866-733-6786. You can also join us by email, forum@kqed.org. Or you can post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can go to our Facebook page. But let's, in the meantime, go to your calls. And Ken, we begin with you. Good morning.
good morning. How would you define extrovert? I have read, and my understanding is from growing up, that an extrovert is one who is outgoing, but that doesn't tell us very much. The best definition I heard was one who gains energy from being around others, and where it's the opposite with an introvert. And that made a lot of sense to me, because that's how I felt in conversing with strangers and actually gaining energy and feeling a bit exhilarated from a nice interaction with someone, typically platonic. But how would you define that?
I think that both of the characteristics that you mentioned are part of this dimension extroversion. And so that's really good. Yes, people who are high in extroversion are outgoing, and they also gain strength and pleasure and happiness from being surrounded by others. But let me point out one key thing just in the way you said things about extrovert versus introvert. The idea, which is now well accepted, is that this is a dimensional term. Some people are very high in extroversion. Some people are very low in extroversion or high in introversion. But it's spectral. In other words, you're not either an extrovert or an introvert. You can be somewhere in between. So, but indeed, the characteristics of extroversion that you mentioned, including both being outgoing and getting pleasure and energy from being surrounded by others, are both part of that dimension called extroversion.
Yeah, you have a lot of synonyms: gregariousness, assertiveness, excitement seeking, and cheerfulness. There are people who act like extroverts but are really introverts, or they act like introverts but they're really extroverts, and it does sometimes reminds me of David Riesman saying there are outer directed people and inner directed people. It's kind of along those lines.
Yes, it is. I mean, and as I say, this is dimensional. I mean, people are not pure. Clinton might be viewed as a pure extrovert, if you will, because he is so very, very high on all the characteristics which go together to make extroversion. But some people are, you know, are somewhere a little bit more in between. They're not extremes. And as one learns to use the five factors and their facets, which I describe in the book, one can characterize people with, you know, in a finer way. But the basic idea that these things tend to go together, that the aspects of extroversion tend to go together, which means presumably that your brain is tuned in a certain way, that certain circuits are tuned in a certain way, is, I think, pretty sound. And as the caller, as Ken said, there are aspects of extroversion. It's not just one thing.
A lot of people have been asking about the five. I think we touched upon them. Maybe we ought to touch upon them a little bit more.
Okay.
We've talked about extroversion and agreeableness, which has to do with trust and straightforwardness and altruism and modesty and all of those kinds of things. But conscientiousness, conscientiousness for you is more of a sense of competence, of self-efficacy, of orderliness and dutifulness and those kinds of
yes,
things.
Yes, and it's not for me. This is what – this I'm just –
I mean, for what you've synthesized. Yeah.
Yes, from what I've synthesized from the work of many, many people who've been studying these five factors for
– what do they call it? Neo-PIR?
Yeah, well, Neo-PIR is one particular branded test for these five factors, which was developed by two psychologists at the NIH. There is, however, a public version, which is non-proprietary, and I give a link in my book to it, which is available and which is which was created by a number of experts in the field, where you can take the test for free, anonymously, and immediately get feedback by computer, which will tell you how you rank on all these things in some detail. It's actually a wonderful service. It's free. It's anonymous. Nobody will know who you are. You can use a fake name if you want to, but you will get a very nice profile of these five factors for free if you just use the link in the book, which is not created by me, but created by outstanding psychologists who've worked on this for decades.
Let's just touch on the others. We mentioned extroversion and introversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness. Neuroticism. Now, that's something that ought to be a little more quantified here, what we mean by being neurotic.
Yes. Okay. Neuroticism, you know, and these words are just, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to name these factors with a word. And these words can be argued about and are imperfect.
Are people who come right to mind, you think neurotic personality, you think Woody Allen, you know.
Well, Woody Allen is actually very high in neuroticism, but the characteristics of neuroticism really are about negative emotionality, feeling negative emotionality, a propensity to be nervous, tense, depressed, to feel gloomy.
Anxious?
Anxious, yes. So people high in neuroticism, vulnerable, sensitive to the criticisms of others. People high in neuroticism have those characteristics. The opposite is called emotional stability. And people at the other end of the spectrum could care less, you know, are more serene, are not tense, but are relaxed.
Potentially insensitive, maybe, too?
Not necessarily.
Not caring and apathetic?
No, not necessarily. This is more about feeling negative emotion. There's also the dimension positive emotion, which is more in the extroversion kind of category. So people who are not neurotic are not necessarily not caring or not emotional. They may actually be very high in positive emotions, but they just don't get too upset.
And then finally, you have openness.
Openness to experience. That's about people who are open to new ideas, who are curious, inquisitive, as opposed to, at the other extreme, people who are conservative, who don't want change, who like everything to be just as it is, who are comfortable by sticking to the rules, by sticking to conventions, etc. And this again can distinguish people quite remarkably. If you think, you know, of the people in your life. Lots of us know a lot of open people, so we think that everybody is open. But there's a large segment of the world which is much more comfortable with keeping things just as they are, which is the dimension called closedness. And there's nothing bad about it. Being open or closed, and whether you like being open or closed, matter of personal taste. But there are people who can be categorized at one end of the spectrum or at the other end of the spectrum, or, as in many of us, somewhere in between.
So I'm sure you know, the great German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said there are Dionysian types and there are Apollonian types. And he was really talking about personalities, those who are like the god Apollo and those who are like the Dionysius, Bacchanalian god. And yet there are many people who think of themselves as being, you know, more like the Dionysian, more outgoing, more extroverted and so forth. And so they kind of pretend to be that. It's not necessarily their real personality.
Well, I think that there are masks. We use masks. Personality is absolutely because we have conceptions of who we would like to be like, which may be somewhat different from who we think we are like. And we struggle with this. And to some extent, we can shift ourselves. It's not in – that is, we may be born extroverted or introverted and want to be the other way around. Mostly, most people – and certainly in this culture, they want to be extroverted. And all the introverts want to be extroverted. There are books written now about be happy you're an introvert because it's not so bad to be an introvert. It really is not so bad to be an introvert. But the modal, the people who seem to be most admired now are Lady Gaga. You know, it's like outrageous people who can just get up there and do whatever they goddamn please. And so others want to, I want to be more like that. I want to be outgoing. I don't want to be a stick in the mud. I don't want to be shy and resting in the corner. But the reality is that people are distributed by their nature along that spectrum, but they can try to shift because of cultural pressures, etc.
And so often do. I can't help thinking about a line of Vonnegut's that was very popular, you are who you pretend to be. And
well,
that's certainly true to a great extent.
Well, now we get to the issue of identity. See, that is – we're in the book, I've got like four different things.
Temperament, character, identity, all of those kind of terms which we could each spend an hour on.
Yes. But you see, the thing that you raised with Vonnegut is indeed this issue of identity, which is just as important as the dispositional traits. So just as the dispositional traits are heavily influenced by genetic factors and circumstances in growing up and tend to become fairly stable by the time we're 25 or 30 years old, there's the issue. There's that other piece of big piece of personality, which is at the other end, which is the big picture piece of personality. Who do you want to be when you grew up? How do you think you? What do you think of your history and how you got to be the way you are and where you headed and what is the meaning of your life? That all falls into this other realm of personality, which is called identity and which is equally important, so that you may have these dispositional traits, but if you want to find out what the person is really like, you also want to find out what is meaningful to them. What do they want? What do they think of themselves?
What do they really care about?
What do they care about? What do they stand for? What do they hope for? What do they want to be? And how do they see themselves and the continuity of their life? Because amazingly enough, human beings have this picture of who they are. And it's not stated in terms of the five factors. It's stated in terms of goals, aspirations, meaning. And so that's another aspect of personality, and that one is the one you were just alluding to.
Let's go to more of our calls, and we welcome Will from Berkeley. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to go back to a comment your guest was mentioning the evolution of these personality traits, and I was curious about the co-evolution of these traits, because if everybody's an extrovert, then Bill Clinton wouldn't have an audience.
Yeah.
So I'm really, with interest in his opinion. I think this is a great show. It's really interesting.
I think
and I'll take any comment off the air.
Thank you. I think you're raising, of course. I mean, you're getting into the whole issue of the theory of evolution of personality, and indeed, one of the factors that shapes the evolution of personality is the personalities of others. That is, to make a long story short. One might argue there are these various studies that have been done or modelings that have been done about, for example, hawks versus doves. Now hawks,
we're not talking about the birds. We're talking about the feelings toward war. Yeah.
War. Right. That one could argue that, belligerence, and having long talons, etc., is highly adaptive. So why isn't everybody like a super hawk? What's the role for doves? And so people have modeled the problems that as the hawk population gets bigger and bigger, they start killing each other off because they're all fighting for the same stuff, and the doves kind of hide in the corner. And so eventually some kind of equilibrium is established between the two different dispositions where each one is acting as a selective factor for the other. Just the point that the caller was making about how interactions between different personality characteristics shape each other and lead to some dimension where people are at different, and that is a distribution, an equilibrium of people at different parts in different parts of the spectrum. It's all pretty theoretical, but it's directly to the point that the caller was making.
And we thank the caller, and we go to another caller, and that's you, Joe. You're on.
Hi.
Joe, I think we're going to need another line for you. Let me get another caller on here. Judith, good morning.
Good morning. Your guest was a few moments ago referring to positive and negative emotions.
Yes.
And my psychiatrist specifically doesn't like to use those terms, and I was interested in your guest elaborating a little bit on his thoughts about those.
I'm not sure why. I mean, positive and negative emotions are real. I mean, when you're happy and cheerful and gay, you know what that feels like. And when you're gloomy and sad and nervous, you know what that feels like.
Well, what's your psychiatrist's opposition to that language? Do you know, Judith?
Their connotation that they're.
I see. You mean
they,
he doesn't? He may not
values,
like.
Yeah.
He may not like the words positive and negative, where positive means good and negative means bad.
He or she.
Right. I don't know. I don't use them in the sense of good or bad. I use them in the sense of up and down. Positive emotions are ones where you feel up. Negative emotions are ones where you feel down. Now, one can argue that it's good to feel down sometimes. So maybe you don't like the terminology negative, that negative could be good. So as I say, I and the way that they're used in the psychological literature that I'm referring to is not evaluative. It's descriptive, where positive means up and negative means down.
Judith, we thank you for the call. Here's a listener who writes on the web the question, Sarah by name, can you cure someone who is a narcissist or sociopath? If not, why not?
Well, you can certainly limit their behavior, and you can certainly learn how to deal with them. More to the point, people's tendencies to be narcissistic or sociopathic are strongly established, but not irrevocably. Everybody is susceptible to some degree of change, but the most important thing in terms of practicality that I would suggest that one can learn from identifying them is in learning how you deal with them rather than by embarking on a course of modifying their behavior or changing their personality. The key thing to identifying them is figuring out how you should deal with them, whether it be stay away from them because they're so toxic or learn to deal with them recognizing that they're exploitative and needful of admiration, etc. But trying to change them is a very difficult task, and it's not the practical one that I recommend. Learning to deal with them is what you need to do.
How much do personalities change in general?
I think that's a very big question. And aspects of personality change. Some aspects of personality can change more than others. For example, the big five factors tend to stabilize by the time we're 30, 40, 50. They keep getting progressively more stable. Identity.
Stable or hardened?
Stable.
Cemented.
Well, actually, William James said that, that the personality is set in plaster by the time you're 30, hardened. I think the general consensus now is that it's softer, it's more malleable than James in his.
Actually, I'm reminded of Scott Fitzgerald, The End of the Great Gatsby, when Nick says, "It's my 30th birthday. I'm 30 years old now. I'm too old to lie to myself anymore."
Well, 30 seems to be a big marking point in terms of certainly dispositional trait development, but it's not set in stone. But it's, on the other hand, identity can change a lot with circumstances. One's vision of oneself can change considerably for a variety of reasons. Life circumstances, philosophical changes, religious changes, etc. People can indeed alter their identity at a significantly more advanced age. And that, as I say, is one of the really key pieces of personality. So they may be shy still and not change their shyness. Well, they can learn to do public speaking even if they're shy, so there's that. But in terms of who they are and what they stand for, that can change significantly over the course of a lifetime.
Listener wants to know if you have any thoughts on Myers-Briggs personality tests.
Yeah, I think the Myers-Briggs personality tests actually cover a lot of the same stuff that the five factors do. They specifically leave out the factor called neuroticism. There's a whole history to the Myers-Briggs personality tests. They're used a lot. They can be very useful. They're used a lot in occupational testing. They do indeed measure, they measure extroversion and introversion. That's one of the things in the Myers-Briggs test. They tend to be more typological than dimensional, although I think that's changing too. That is, they're more inclined to say you are an extrovert or an introvert, whereas their tests are dimensional, and I think that the people who administer them are becoming more flexible in that regard. So anyway, it's a way of doing personality testing, which is actually very popular in industry. And to deal with its relationship to the big five would be a long story.
Roberto, you're on with us. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. My question is from your program, and thank you for the program, is that most characteristics, extrovert, introvert, et cetera, are seemingly genetic based, or that one tends to fall because of genetics one side to the other. Does that apply to schizophrenia as well?
Yes. Well, actually, one of the things that we've learned about behavior in general is that all behavioral tendencies have a significant genetic influence. How much depends on the tendency, but yes, genes influence, but don't completely control and are not the only factor in all kinds of behavior, be they normal personality variations or the more extreme variations, which we call mental illnesses like schizophrenia.
Let me thank the caller. Listener Susan writes, I'm just tuning into this discussion. I'm very curious about why the diagnostic manual writers decided to do away with the category of narcissistic personality disorder. I have met a number of people who seem to be afflicted, and I was raised by one.
Yes. Okay. That's actually a really interesting question. The diagnostic manual people are really struggling with this right now. I'm not a member of that panel, but I do know a little bit about what's going on. And they indeed, at one point, not very long ago, were going to get rid of narcissistic personality. And now I gather it's having a renaissance. So I think that we'll have to see what they put out. I must say that they have put themselves, the people who are dealing with the personality disorders section of the DSM-5, the fifth version of the Psychiatry's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, are in a very sorry state right now, because they recognize on the one hand that all these things are dimensional. That is, you're not either a narcissist or not a narcissist, but the whole diagnostic manual and so much of medicine is categorical, either yes or no. So they're struggling with this fundamental nosological problem of categories versus dimensions. They know the problem. The people who are working on it are smart, but they're just having a hard time of it.
We did a whole hour on this. I mean, some of these things are like, you know, putting Jell-O on a tree. I mean, especially when you're talking about borderline personalities. Right?
Yes, you see. So, take borderline personality, which is going to be kept in the DSM-5. So that's actually basically what borderline personality is, if you will, or what that it's also really dimensional. It's to my mind, and as I treat it in the book, extreme neuroticism. People with borderline personality have as their most salient features extreme neuroticism, extreme emotional instability. It's not like something that's out of the blue, some separate kind of thing that's out of the realm of normal humanity. All these personality disorders, and indeed all psychiatric disorders, including major depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, have to be thought of in exactly the same context as personality disorders. These are manifestations of both genetic and environmental variations that come together, form a brain in a certain way, and set a particular pattern of behavior. And so the whole issue of personality differences and mental illness really needs to be merged. And the people who understand this know it, but the diagnostic manual is in a mess.
Here's Ken from Sacramento. Hi, Ken. Join us.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Your guest is like psychic, because I'm autistic, and I was going to touch on the variables, you know, in relation to psychological disorders. And in my case, I was recently diagnosed, so I spent 50 years of hell, and the last year, I feel great. I'm in therapy and medication. So I guess what I want to say is, like, there's no definitive end or beginning. You know, there is help and there is resources out there available. So for any of your listeners hearing that, I just want them to be aware of that.
Well, talk about positive emotions. That's really good to hear.
That's great, yes.
And thank you for that. Let me go to another call. Talk about diagnostic difficulties. The whole realm of the spectrum of Asperger and autism,
yes,
is another very confounding kind.
Absolutely. Asperger's, autism, and what's called in the personality disorders thing, schizoid personality. What is the relationship between they all have characteristics which are very similar, and splitting them out is really very hard. I mean, that is, if you do it descriptively, you can make descriptive definitions that distinguish them. But in my view, they all are within a similar dimension and probably have a very similar genetic predisposition. And when we finally one day understand how it all works, which may take a long time, I think one will see that they overlap tremendously.
Getting a lot of requests from listeners for the five personality types. Is there a site or a website so they can just look at information?
Yes, there. I cite it in my book. I don't have it written down before me, but there is a website which offers this five-factor personality test. It's non-commercial. It's free. It's anonymous. You can take the test and you can get your scores immediately by return.
You know, we'll get
email.
It on our website. How's
yeah,
that?
Great.
So people can find it later on there. And in the meantime, we'll go to Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I've been waiting and waiting for Dr. Barandas to make some reference to into the concept of allostatic load and how it affects just, never mind personality, just daytime executive functioning. And probably some of the worst instigators of allostatic load are alcohol and sleep restriction or deprivation. So many people just self-impose sleep restriction on themselves. Anyway, if he could please talk about it in that context. It's been 30 years since Hans Selye wrote his book, Stress Without Distress, and near as I can tell, hardly anybody in what passes for psychiatry makes reference to that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Well, yes. I mean, I think the reader is referring to the fact that various forms of stress interact with personalities, or you know, can interact with any of us and can cause significant behavioral changes. The way that these stresses work and how they express themselves is, of course, interactive with the personality. So there are personalities who are extraordinarily resilient and who are not terribly influenced by stresses, which will tip other people off into depression and severe emotional deterioration. So, yes, indeed, stress and major stress have a very important effect on people's behavior, but they interact with the basic dispositional traits which vary and which we call personality.
We've got seconds left. I want to read one web comment because it does disagree with you. This is Christina who writes, I disagree with the doctor's conclusion about why there are natural variants in personality. I believe there are differences in people because we're social species who are interdependent, similar to ants or bees. Our species as a whole is more successful when we have both big picture idea generators and detail-oriented individuals. Having both introverted and extroverted people in every society is advantageous at any time in history. We all have a role to play and every personality has value.
I completely agree with that. That's exactly the point that I make, so we're not in disagreement at all.
I didn't think you were, so I want to get that on the record.
Good.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
Samuel Brandes, his new book is Making Sense of People, Decoding the Mysteries of Personality. You can continue this discussion by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory, our engineer, Danny Bringer, and our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.